Pleases the court, Wendy Wilcox Esquire from the Bar of California. She's with the law firm of Skane Wilcox.
Please
and
stand.
She has been admitted pro hoc in these regards previously.
Thank you.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the court.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Richard Horowitz from Potter Anderson on behalf of Intel, the appellant. And with me today, Dan Bagatelle from Perkins Coie, who will be arguing. He has been admitted pro hoc vice. Lester Brown, also from the Perkins Coie firm, is at council table with me, along with my colleague, John Sensing.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Welcome to the court.
Good afternoon.
Are counsel ready?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Bagatelle on behalf of the appellant, Intel Corporation. In this case, Intel has turned to its excess insurer, AGLI, to help defend massive litigation that has been extraordinarily expensive to defend. AGLI has argued that its policy was not triggered because the underlying limits of Excel's primary insurance policy were not exhausted. The Superior Court agreed. But it's undisputed that Intel first turned to Excel and reached a coverage settlement under which Excel and Intel agreed that the two would pay $50 million. The $50 million was paid out, and thus AGLI got the buffer for which it bargained. AGLI admits that Intel was entitled to contribute to exhaustion for purposes of triggering its duty to indemnify. Its argument is that Intel wasn't entitled to do the same thing in order to trigger AGLI's duty to defend.
That's really the single issue, isn't that correct?
Yeah.
That is, there's no question that the $50 million threshold was met.
Correct.
The question is whether it must be met solely by the underlying carrier in order to trigger the excess carrier's duty to defend.
That's right. And it's agreed that Intel was entitled to contribute in order to trigger the duty to indemnify. Their argument is that the same is not hold true for purposes of the duty to defend. And that's quite counterintuitive and not compelled by the policy language.
But that's the issue, is whether
that
it's
certainly is
by the policy
the issue.
Language.
In fact, to put a finer point on it, the question here is not really whose reading is the best single reading of the policy. This is an insurance policy. It's not a statute. Under California law, the issue is whether the policy is reasonably susceptible to Intel's interpretation. And in this case, the policy had two exhaustion provisions. It had Condition H and Paragraph C. Condition H expressly allowed Intel to contribute to exhaustion, and Paragraph C was silent on that point. Moreover, AGLI has never explained why anyone would write a policy that would allow Intel to contribute to the duty to triggering the duty to indemnify, but not for purposes of the duty to defend. That argument's especially dubious given the nature of Excel's underlying coverage. This was a so-called...
The district court in California ruled against you as well as the Superior Court here, correct?
Yes. Originally, the district court ruled in our favor, and then it changed its mind and ruled in favor of AGLI, but on a different basis, incidentally, than the Superior Court did here. So we have two different courts that reached the same result in favor of AGLI, but for somewhat different reasons.
Is that an alternative basis to affirm the Superior Court?
An alternative basis of?
To affirm the Superior Court here, in other words, to adopt the approach of the federal court in California.
This court could follow the logic of the federal court or the arguments of AGLI as alternative grounds to support the judgment. We don't think that would be correct. We believe that at a minimum, the policy is reasonably susceptible to Intel's interpretation, and that compels reversal of the judgment of no exhaustion and remand for purposes of determining whether AGLI hadn't reached the duty to defend. But it's certainly within your power to follow whichever logic you deem to be correct. My point, though, is that there's no one necessarily proper reading of an insurance policy. There can be multiple reasonable readings. And if we have a reasonable reading, then under settled California principles, we prevail. It's AGLI who drafted these exhaustion provisions, and it was incumbent on AGLI to draft them in a way that was clear and unambiguous in a way to exclude coverage. We submit
how do you
they didn't.
Distinguish Qualcomm other than the policy language?
Qualcomm's policy language was radically different. Actually, I encourage you to take a look at the very last sentence of the Qualcomm decision and where they point out that it really did turn on the policy, language, and circumstances in that case. I've got the language here. In that case, the policy required the insurers under each of the underlying policies to have paid or been held liable to pay the full amount of the underlying limit of liability. So it clearly spelled out who had to pay, the insurers, and how much they had to pay, the full amount. And that was the language on which the court decided the case. It was clear and unambiguous. The basic holding of the case was that public policy principles such as those set out in Zeig couldn't trump clear and unambiguous policy language. But we don't have that language here. First of all, we have Condition H, which expressly allowed Intel to contribute. But even if you were to ignore Condition H, Paragraph C didn't say who had to contribute. It said the policy limits must be exhausted. They must be exhausted. It did not say who must contribute to that, nor did it say expressly that XL had to pay out the full amounts. That's what happened in Qualcomm. That's not what happened here.
So your contention is because the language, the critical language of the policy, is in the passive voice, doesn't specify who must pay the $50 million. That fact, plus the fact that to construe that language to require the underlying insurer to make that payment would be an unreasonable construction because it would make the duty to defend narrower than the duty to indemnify.
It certainly would be a very unusual and implausible construction. And so our view is that if AGLI wanted to write it so that Intel could contribute to exhausting for purposes of triggering the duty to indemnify but not the duty to defend, it could do that, but it needed to use clear language, which it didn't do.
I'm just trying to fit your position into the doctrine as espoused by the California cases, which I gather is that your side's reading is plausible because there's nothing in the policy that specifies otherwise, and because as a practical matter, it would make no sense in terms of the purpose of a liability policy that carries with it a duty to defend.
Exactly right. There were two exhaustion provisions in the policy. Condition H expressly allowed Intel to contribute. Paragraph C was silent on that subject. There's nothing in either one of them that purports to preclude Intel from contributing to exhaustion. We know that the $50 million was paid. We know that's the interest that AGLI had. AGLI had two interests. One, it wanted Intel to turn to Excel first, which it clearly did. It took a long time to reach a coverage settlement. And second, it had an interest in making sure there was a $50 million buffer, or 66 if you want to include the self-insured retention in the fronting policy. There was that buffer before it would be on the hook. It got the benefit of that bargain. So we submit there's no reason to read the policy that way. But even if it's ambiguous, the ambiguities have to be read in our favor because it was AGLI who drafted the policy language. I do want to address AGLI.
This comes up on a motion for summary judgment.
Correct.
I gather there's no dispute that in terms of the duty to indemnify, there's no requirement, that is, that the company can contribute.
There's no dispute about that. Condition H is expressed in that regard.
And that if, although as a theoretical matter, it's possible to draft a policy that would restrict, create a greater restriction to trigger the duty to indemnify, one would think that since we're on a summary judgment record that there would have developed some evidence of the business reason behind a policy of that kind, that is for marketing and selling a policy of that kind. Is there any evidence to that effect?
None. There's no evidence that AGLI sought to impose a different exhaustion provision that would require XL and XL alone to trigger the defense duty. There's no exchange of correspondence like that.
Negotiation history.
None that I'm aware of.
Is there any evidence in the record of any policy that has those disparate provisions?
I have not seen any. In fact, I've got a chart here of several pages of the decisions in this area, and none of them had language like that. So this really would be an extraordinarily unusual type policy, and our point is that if AJLI wanted to do that, they needed to use clear language, and they did not do that.
Well, the counter to that argument is that Intel is a, you know, is a grown-up. They, you know, can't pretend that they're, you know, they are a commercial insured. You know, they're not an individual insured. They don't need the kind of protection that's ordinarily afforded by the default rule in the case of ambiguity. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is that there's no distinction under California law. Under California law, the question is who wrote the language and is who is going to suffer as a result of the ambiguity. In this case, we know that AJLI, or Zurich, the parent, drafted the exhaustion provisions. I found nothing in California law that suggests that Intel wouldn't benefit from that rule simply because Intel is a large corporation. The fact of the matter is this was given to Intel, and they took it. There wasn't a negotiation where Intel wrote part of this language. It was language that came from the insurer and therefore must be construed against the insurer.
All right, so your argument is, number one, there's nothing in the text of the policy that gives notice to the insured that the insured is taking this position or will take this position in connection with the duty to defend or triggering the duty to defend. And there's nothing factual in this record that shows that the insured here, Intel, was put on notice, that that's the meaning that the insurer was ascribing to the policy.
That's correct. And even if one could read the policy their way, it's not the only reasonable reading, and therefore we have to prevail.
Well, the Superior Court said that Condition H does not relate to the duty to defend. What's wrong with that?
Well, the Superior Court's logic was basically the argument that AJLI makes in its brief, that you need to look at the policy somehow chronologically. It is true that H was originally included in AJLI's form policy, but that's not the policy the parties agreed to. The parties agreed to that policy combined with Endorsement 1, which created a duty to defend. And under California law, you need to read them together. The critical language in H is that the insured, Intel, or the insured's underlying insurance, Excel, together must pay the $50 million. But the question there was whether coverage was triggered. And the coverage under the policy as adopted was both a duty to defend and a duty to indemnify. You can't view them segmentedly. I found no case law whatsoever indicating that you look at some sort of chronological history in circumstances where the parties adopted all of these provisions simultaneously. Again, even if that's a plausible reading on behalf of AJLI, it's not the only reasonable reading. It's certainly reasonable for Intel to think that its coverage included the duty to defend and as well as the duty to indemnify. So you can't just toss out the condition H on that ground. The other rationale I think that's been used is that there was a heading saying damages, but that heading referred to another portion of that paragraph, and we also know from the underlying Excel policy that headings don't control. So what you have to look at is the language. AJLI's coverage was triggered if some combination of Intel and Intel's underlying insurer paid $50 million. That's exactly what's happened here. The word coverage isn't really disputed. You can look at Black's Law Dictionary, the best glossary of insurance terms, even the Superior Court's opinion, even AJLI's brief uses the word coverage to include the duty to defend as well as the duty to indemnify. And we submit that at a minimum, a reasonable insured can read the word coverage in a policy that covers both the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify and say that covers both of them. So for that reason, I think it was incorrect to toss out Condition H entirely. And again, you have to read Condition H in light of the entire policy, not simply where it was originally drafted, because that's not the policy the parties agreed to in the end. The other argument that AJLI has made for ignoring Condition H is that somehow it would render paragraph C superfluous, but that's just not true. If you look at paragraph C, it contains an additional requirement that exhaustion be by virtue of judgments or settlements. And that's, frankly, an unusual provision to include in a burden limits policy whereby, excuse me, the payments for defense and payments for indemnity count equally towards burning up the XL limits. That's an unusual provision to have in there, but it's there. And we've followed that. We waited until we had a judgment or a settlement, which meant we were done with XL, as a result of which $50 million had been paid. So that was an additional requirement in paragraph C that didn't appear in condition H. And so the two can certainly be read together. And nobody has concluded that paragraph C somehow read condition H entirely out of the policy. So we submit both of them applied, both of them were satisfied here. And as a result, Intel is entitled to reach the AGLI policy. We'll have a second issue as to whether there was an actual duty to defend under that policy, which turns under on issues of advertising injury, which the Superior Court hasn't reached yet because it went off on this predicate exhaustion issue. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Again, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to start, if I may, Justices, in giving a very brief overview of the unique circumstance that's presented by this appeal today. And then I'd like to swing into, if I may, a couple of questions that Justice Jacobs has asked, which I'd like to address. You, as a reviewing panel, have a unique opportunity today because you not have just one decision which provides guidance as to what an underlying court has done. You have two decisions. And the two decisions, one from the Superior Court here in Wilmington and the Northern District of California, both looked at the same contracts, applied the same law, and reach the same conclusions. The process that both trial court judges used were identical.
Excuse me, if I can just interrupt. With respect to the California decision.
Yes, Justice.
Is that under appeal or not?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. As we mentioned in our brief somewhere, I think it might be a footnote, the disposition time in the Ninth Circuit can be up to 3 years. Briefing is done. There's no oral argument scheduled. But I would also emphasize one of the very disparate points about the two cases is Intel chose to sue just AGLI in California. It was part of a process of going one insurer at a time up a tower, notwithstanding the fact that they were incurring very, very large defense expenses, and the amount of those actual expenditures are in the record. It's under seal. I'm not permitted to go into them today, but it's there. Unprecedented. Notwithstanding that, they chose to go one at a time. And, Your Honor, not to get off topic, but to complete the thought, Intel takes the position for the very first time in their reply brief, that in actuality, we did give credence to paragraph C of endorsement one, and for the first time in the reply brief said, we actually guided our conduct according to C. And we waited till we finished our one-off litigation against XL, which they never told Zurich about, and only then, because of C, did we come to you. What the record shows in the record before you is that they not only spent dollars well in excess of the XL policy, but at the time they reached their settlement, they were well north of the Zurich limits. And it is in the record, 1 year after the filing of the litigation, in January of 2010, the amount of money they had spent, and that's an affidavit from one of the financial people at Intel. So, Your Honor, to look at the briefs, it's almost Dickens-esque. Throughout the proceedings in both trial courts, Intel took the position. The policy was clear and unambiguous. In the opening briefs here, they say the same thing. In the reply brief, they now say ambiguous, reasonable expectations, no extrinsic evidence allowed, etc. Well, Your Honor, I'd like to put some color on that. What happened here, because of the procedural issues, is we had two cases. A federal judge decided he liked this case and wanted to keep it out in San Francisco, and Judge Herlihy had the more comprehensive case and said, no, it belongs here where I can make one decision which will bind everybody. And that was his decision. They have not appealed that. So off we go into litigation. Intel filed the motion for summary judgment in the Northern District first. They took the position, and it's in the record of the district court that's before you, that the policy was clear and unambiguous and no extrinsic evidence was permitted. We actually litigated the issue on a one-off point, and they opposed it. Their briefs here until the reply take the same issue. Now, when we were in front of the trial court, in the submissions, Intel was very careful and said the policy is clear and unambiguous. And the reason they took that view was they had a motion pending in front of Judge Fogel out in California where they took certain positions and were trying to rush a decision.
If I can interrupt just for one minute.
Yes, Justice.
I'm concerned about the posture of any decision that this court renders, given that there is an appeal still pending in the Ninth Circuit. What would be the impact either way?
Well, I think the impact, Your Honor, is a decision by this court would end the Delaware litigation, which has before it all of the possible insurance related to Intel's massive antitrust problem.
Right, but what would happen with the appeal to the Ninth Circuit?
Well, Your Honor, we would certainly ask them to take judicial notice of this decision, and we would attempt to get their attention to shortcut that. Whether that would be successful or not, it would be up to the Ninth Circuit. It's the busiest circuit in the country.
Could the Ninth Circuit, would it be possible that they might come out with a ruling that was different from the ruling of this court?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court has a very good affirmance rate with the Ninth Circuit. It was a
I'm asking
judge.
You, this is a theoretical question.
Yeah, and you're leaving me with sort of theoretical responses. Is it possible? We don't believe so. Is there a risk? Yes, we think it's very, very slight. And the reason we say that is we take great comfort in the fact that you have two judges who had ultimately a full record on this issue who came out exactly the same under California law, applying the same contracts. So, Your Honor, that is the elephant in the room, if you will, in terms of being able to develop a record. Now, Your Honor, and I'm referring to a question you asked, Justice Jacobs, of my adversary, you asked what the record below looked like with extrinsic evidence. And I want to just make sure the record is clear. There wasn't any, because Intel took the position in both courts that there was no need for extrinsic evidence because the contract was clear and unambiguous. The problem results from the fact that two judges, but focusing on the Superior Court here, That court went to great lengths to examine the contracts, California law, and if you look at the decisions of both courts, they use the same process.
Let me interrupt for a second.
Yes, Justice Berger.
Intel took the position that no extrinsic evidence should be permitted because the terms of the policy were clear and unambiguous, correct?
That is correct.
What's your position with respect to that?
Our position has always been it is clear and unambiguous. You have...
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So, and the same thing happened in the California court, that both sides said it was clear and unambiguous.
That is correct. It wasn't until the reply brief here that we've heard this reasonable expectations issue and extrinsic evidence, et cetera.
Okay. And now getting back to what Justice Jacobs was pursuing for a moment, you indicated that there's a risk of inconsistent decisions and that you're comfortable because, after all, two trial courts looked at the same issue and reached the same result. What if this court were to reverse? Wouldn't that put us in something of an awkward situation in terms of the decisions of two different courts having jurisdiction of this matter?
Potentially it might, Your Honor. Yes.
In other words, it's possible, theoretically, to follow up on Justice Berger's question, that if we were to issue a decision reversing, that our decision could be undone by the Ninth Circuit if it chose to go a different way.
No. With all due respect, now I understand Justice Berger's comment. It cannot be undone. That court has virtually no... I was in the courtroom when Justice Jacobs was asking about the Supremacy Clause earlier this morning. You're an independent court. What you decide is a final judgment. And what's important about this court and what the trial court recognized early on was Intel's litigation conduct of doing one piece at a time up a tower, even though their exposure, which is in the record, was implicating the entire tower, was non-economically a good idea. It raised the potential of inconsistent decisions, if you will, just Justice Berger, to your point. And what Judge Hurley, he said, is on complex insurance cases like this, you need to have all potential parties in front of one judge who can issue a comprehensive ruling. Because if you remember, our case not only is against Intel, we have also said, if for any reason...
Well, let's stop for a minute. You know, I asked whether a decision reversing Judge Hurley could be undone by the Ninth Circuit. You said, no, it can't. You didn't tell me why. Is it because of res judicata, or is there some other basis?
Oh, I'm sorry. I heard it differently. That's why I addressed Justice Berger. No, could the Ninth Circuit, if you were to theoretically reverse, could the Ninth Circuit affirm Judge Fogler? The answer is they could.
Okay. And then where are we?
And then we have an even more complicated case, Your Honor, and I guess that's what they have the U.S. Supreme Court for, potentially, because we would go back, in this case, we would go back and start over, because the only thing that's occurred in this case are these motions. Discovery hasn't started in earnest. We would have to go back and deal with all the issues that one might have to deal with in a complex insurance case. But I would suggest, Your Honor, because insurance is a state law issue, all the parties have agreed that California law applies. We have two judges who applied California law. And I come back once again. They were independent of each other. Now, when Judge Fogel issued the first order in the summer, he didn't have the benefit of Judge Herlihy's decision. As soon as he got that decision, he put the brakes on, and he ordered a series of supplemental briefings that fall. There was no more argument. He then reached an independent decision the following December, saying, you know what? I've seen a full record. I am comfortable that, in fact, the Intel Corporation did not satisfy the terms and conditions of the AGLI policy. Now, the other point here that has been stressed by Intel is the fact that reasonable expectations we thought, well, putting aside for a moment, because we've dealt with it, the fact that they never raised it below, California law is clear, and both judges dealt with it. You don't get to reasonable expectations if the court finds one of the parties' explanation is the most reasonable, and the courts in both of these cases went further, and they said Intel's proffered explanation is unreasonable because it violates California law.
Now, the statement of...
I'm sorry. I just want to let you know you're using your co-counsel's time.
Oh, then I do want to defer to, out of respect. May I answer Justice Ridley?
Sure. Off the clock.
Okay.
All right. The California Supreme Court, you say under California law, is that according to the California Supreme Court, or are we back to the Court of Appeals? In other words, is there any value of having a California Supreme Court clarification of any issue in the case?
No, Your Honor, because the contract principles in this case are well settled under California law. I refer you to Qualcomm. Look at Qualcomm for contract integrity and giving purpose to every clause in a contract. Both trial courts went at that issue and found the same thing.
Oh, but I was wrong. You still have 2 minutes, so say whatever you like.
Thank you. I'd like to just...
You're saying, just to follow up on that, you're saying that this case does not involve a principle of California law, but rather an application of settled principles to a particular fact situation, and therefore certification wouldn't be helpful or available?
That's correct, Justice Jacobs. This case, and you look at Union Oil, you look at Qualcomm, and I would note that Intel doesn't provide you with any California law supporting their position. They try and distinguish Qualcomm, Hurley, Union Oil, but the contract applications utilized by both trial courts were identical, and the results were identical. And for that reason, to answer Justice Jacobs one more time, we don't think this would lend itself to either the district court or the Ninth Circuit saying, you know what, we'd like to seek certification of this issue to the California court. They had the opportunity to take the Qualcomm case, and they turned it down. Thank you. If there are no other questions, I think I've completed my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be brief. We represent Lumbermans, which is above the AGLI policy, and it's part of a quota share that includes Chartis, Excel, also, our client, and Liberty Mutual. And the reason why I wanted to say something here today, only because Intel brought us into this appeal but didn't bring us into the Delaware case. And I'm having issues with their argument that they say they didn't contact AGLI until they settled with Excel, because Excel is part of our policy and they didn't bring us in. So the argument that they waited to settle with Excel to contact AGLI doesn't make any sense, because if that were the case, then they would also contact us. But the issue is, this isn't really a duty to defend case, because as counsel already pointed out, they had already spent well above all of our limits, and they're asking for us to reimburse them. They're not asking us to forward provide the defense. And so with respect to this, obviously, we join with AGLI's arguments, and we filed the joinder. But I wanted to make clear that where we are in the policy layer and where Intel's argument is and why they waited, and that's also a new argument, doesn't make sense because of that. And if
Well, just so I understand where you're coming from on this, are you also saying that there are other defenses available that other than the policy issues before us now on the duty to defend or to reimburse?
No. Just that this is a reimbursement case. And the contract issues are the ones that are in front of this, in front of your justices here. The problem is that, and what I wanted to point out is that Intel's argument doesn't make sense based on why they waited. Because they had settled hundreds of millions of dollars of policy limits with Xcel for a small amount of money that includes purportedly the layer in our client's quota share that is above the AGLI policy. But they haven't brought our client into this case. So I hope I answered your question. Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just a few points on rebuttal. First, I'd like to address whether it's a new argument that we've said that the contract is at least ambiguous. It is not a new argument. We raised it in the trial court at pages A584 and 85. We raised it in our opening brief to this court, the blue brief at page 16. We did move for summary judgment in California. We still think we have the best reading of the policy. And of course, when you're moving for summary judgment, you move on grounds that you have the better reading of the policy. That is not to say, however, that if the court finds some sort of middle ground where there are multiple readings that are reasonable, that we've somehow given that up. We have consistently said that we think ours is the better and best reading of the policy, but that we don't need that to win. The second point I'd like to address, a lot of the arguments that we just heard are really red herrings. I think it's been pointed out these are really somehow some sort of additional defenses that don't really relate to the issue before the court. As a factual matter, we did notify the insurers, but we turned to have a settlement with Xcel before we sued AGLI. We thought that was the proper thing to do under the policy. That's entirely proper. There's no law that required Intel to go sue everybody all at once and create a big, massive case. The law says we can pick what policy we want to go after as long as it's within the statute of limitations, which it clearly was. Furthermore, as to the idea that the somehow Intel ran up a whole lot of defense expenses, again, that's a totally independent potential defense, but I think you need to realize that under this policy, Intel was entitled to select counsel and essentially control the defense. Intel was entitled to run the defense. This isn't a case like in some insurance policies where the insurers get to select counsel and run the defense. So Intel didn't do anything it wasn't entitled to do. The other major point that was made was that there are two courts that have ruled against us. True. But I have three answers to that. The first is that the two courts analyzed the issues quite differently. And if anything, that shows that this is a very complicated policy that doesn't have a single easy answer to it. Judge Fogel, both of them said Condition H didn't apply, but Judge Fogel said that Condition C was clear and against Intel, and Judge Hurley, he said Condition C didn't really even apply, essentially. His analysis was that judgments and settlements included only judgments and settlements with third parties, a position that AGLI has not tried to defend in this court. Moreover, I think what happened in both cases, what the judges were trying to read the policy like a statute where you can get one right answer. That's just not the way you read insurance policies. Everyone agrees on what the law is. They argue that we've waived it, but everyone agrees that the law is that if there are multiple reasonable readings of the policy, the insured wins. My last point
is...
There's
no principle of law that needs to be resolved by the California Supreme Court.
Well, I hate to give a clever answer, but my view is that the Qualcomm case is clearly distinguishable, that it wouldn't have to be referred to the California Supreme Court, but certainly in its California Rule of Court 8.548, which would allow you to refer a controlling question of law to them. And certainly if you were interested in the question of whether California will follow ZIG, the general rule of ZIG, which is that an insured is entitled to settle with its excess insurer and then fill the gap of any difference between that and the policy limits, unless the policy clearly says otherwise. That's what ZIG says. If you believe that Qualcomm is inconsistent with that and requires affirmance in this case, then I suggest then you should certify it to the California Supreme Court, because that's an issue that's gone around the country since 1928. The majority rule is to follow ZIG. It's certainly there have been three courts in this state that have done so.
What is your position?
Well, we think Zeig is correct, and I think if the California Supreme Court reached the issue, it would. But my point is that even if you take Qualcomm at face value, it decided the result on policy language there that is quite different because it specifically called out who had to pay how much. The insurers under the underlying policies had to pay the full amounts. Well, we don't have that language.
Opposing counsel says there's no controlling principle of law to certify. Your argument, I gather, is that you can craft one.
No, I think the controlling, my view is that the controlling principles of law are the general California principles regarding the reasonable expectations of the insured. But there is a specific issue regarding this Zeig rule. And if you believe that you need to reach that issue to decide the case, then it's certainly within your prerogative to refer it to the California Supreme Court. And if you did so, I presume the Ninth Circuit would also follow suit and do the same thing. I don't think you need to do that.
Your time is up, but since I'm running the show today, I've got one more question.
Sure.
You made reference to where you had in the trial court raised the issue of the language not being clear and unambiguous, that you did raise the prospect that it was subject to two reasonable interpretations. And you made a quick reference to some page numbers. I didn't get them. What page numbers are they from?
Yeah, they're the oral argument on the summary judgment motion at 584 and 585.
In other words, there was nothing in any briefing that raised this matter?
Well, the problem in the trial court was that AGLI didn't mention its condition H argument, its argument that condition H didn't apply until its reply brief. So we didn't have anything to reply to. The best we could do was argue it orally. And at that point, we said, well, even if that's the case, even if you're going to throw H out, it's at least reasonably ambiguous. And again, we did raise it in our opening brief on page 16.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and recess.